Can you hear me eat, DK?
And so can everyone else because we're live.
I can see you eating, but I don't. Oh, we're live. Look at that. We are.
We're live. All right, Steve, yes. Steve's eating. Tell us, what are you eating, Steve? Why are you eating on the show?
It doesn't look like a PB&J, so I need to understand why we're off.
Yeah, eating chocolate. I didn't know we were live, but maybe the viewers can let me know if it's acceptable.
Just make sure to crunch in the microphone.
There we
go. I'm eating an Elon chocolate bar, but not an Elon Musk.
Oh.
Elon University. The alma mater of Austin. Krauss from PB.
Okay.
He had some entrepreneurial students. They were doing a San Francisco roadshow, I think. And he had them swing by here last week.
Right. Yeah.
And it's great. Love speaking to students and who are, I think they're all graduating this spring. So
get them started young.
Trying to figure out what they're going to do.
Yeah.
So Jesse Bosner and I, and I don't know who else in Austin, of course, spoke to them.
Yeah.
We might have even talked about it last week.
I think we did. Yeah.
We did.
Okay. Anyway, well, so we don't have to talk about it.
You spread the good word of Satoshi.
But they were kind enough.
They just brought you a chocolate.
They gave me a little gift bag with chocolate.
Oh, very kind. Elon University, for those that don't know, I believe is in North Carolina. It's in the South.
It's in North Carolina. Yeah.
Yeah. So it makes sense that they would bring a gift. Southern hospitality.
Definitely. It was very nice of them. And why am I eating it right now? I haven't eaten it today. Been rushing around. So didn't want to pass out on the show.
Did you start the morning in New York or you got in?
No, I got back like at 2 a.m.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Very reasonable. But Brian Johnson would not approve of your sleep schedule, I take it.
Or of your chocolate.
I actually got pretty good sleep because I was so crashing from the, not that either. I was, I also gained 2 pounds from the trip. So that's not working towards my goals.
Well, I was going to say, you're looking more ripped today.
That's because I'm wearing my t-shirt.
Exactly.
We have so much. I don't even know if we're going to talk about AI and Bitcoin because they just talk about Steve's morning. But I actually got decent sleep because I was so crashed from the week because it was an amazing week. I actually slept in the flight back.
Okay.
And then so I was able to wake up this morning fine.
Do you pop magnesium or anything? How do you sleep on the flight? Because I can't sleep on flights anymore.
Oh, I just fell asleep.
Nice. Natural.
I worked hard. Worked hard. Yeah.
Work hard. That's it.
I worked hard and work hard I crashed.
Work but, hard, stack sats.
Yeah. Why was I a couple of minutes late for the show?
Yeah.
Today is Dipsy registration.
Oh, it's good.
Oh, yeah.
So for those that do not know what the Dipsy is, it's the second oldest running race in America behind the Boston Marathon.
Mm.
And this will be my fourth year running it. And it's a somewhat unusual race. And it's very hard to get in. You have to apply and there's like all kinds of, you have to like write a sob story.
Yeah.
You can bribe the money.
Is this college admissions?
You need to, if you want to increase your chances, you need to apply the day that they open up registration and do it from the post office in Mill Valley.
Damn.
So I had everything ready, and then I swung by this morning, and the line was so long that I finally just had to bail and get here.
That means you're not registered.
Well, I'll just do it after the show.
Do you think you'll still like it won't like fill up in the morning?
If you do well enough in the race in a previous year, you automatically get it. So I'm good.
Yeah, that's what
but
I was
other,
ask.
I'm registering for other people.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Anyway, so that's why it's a little late. And then why am I wearing this, Max?
Dude, I can't talk about basketball. I've completely.
What makes me sad is Memphis. Memphis is not doing well, so I lose the.
But I'm going to support Iowa State this year because
got to root for Iowa State and Gonzaga.
Yeah.
And actually our newest member of Presidio Bitcoin.
Who's that?
College basketball fan.
The Mara dude?
What?
The Mara dude?
Yeah.
I haven't met him yet. I need to.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah.
And he went to Santa Clara. So he's not only a college basketball fan, but he's a rival of Bailey's Gonzaga team. They actually played in the championship of WCC this year.
They're running the WCC.
Gonzaga won. So I think Santa Clara had a good season, but I don't think they'll make the dance.
Yeah, okay. You know, NIT's not too bad. Yeah. Bro, Memphis has been so bad. Like, I don't even want to talk about it, but like, you remember that, like, there's like the NCAA, then there's like the NIT, which is like the losers tournament. Then there's like the like losers, like NBIL.
Yeah, none of the other stuff. NIT doesn't. No one cares about the NIT. That's like when you don't make the playoffs in your fantasy football league. Yeah. Like, who cares?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I literally tune out if I don't make it.
But I always say, so did y'all already win Big 12? Or no, that's this weekend.
We're in the middle. So
yeah.
We're the seventh ranked team in the nation. And we're
seventh in the Big 12 probably.
Yeah, well, close. It is so stacked. We're the fifth seed in the conference.
Oh, is Houston?
So we didn't even get a bye.
Ooh.
I mean, there's a double. Anyway, we didn't get the bye that Houston, Arizona, Kansas, and Texas Tech got.
How is Big 12 that? I mean, they're good. They've always been good.
Big 12 is stacked.
But how's that?
We're literally the seventh best team in the nation, and we're the fifth best. Yeah. But we're actually better than the fifth best in the Big 12. That's, anyway, and we're proving it out.
Yeah.
On Wednesday, we played Arizona State, which, you know, they're mediocre.
Yeah, James Harden.
They're not bad, but they're not a tourney team.
Yeah,
mediocre. But we beat them 91-42.
That's embarrassing.
It was the largest beatdown in the history of the tournament, and Arizona State's worst loss in like 70 years.
That's crazy.
The next day, then we played a good team, Texas Tech.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
This team to beat Duke, Houston, Arizona. Yeah. Good team.
Good team.
We beat them by 22.
Jesus.
Tonight, we get the real test. We played the best team in the nation, Arizona.
Arizona, okay.
They're 30-2. They're very good.
Okay. I mean, Arizona.
They're all time, like, historical good. So tonight will be a huge test. And then if we win that, then we have to play Houston or Kansas. Well, so I mean, it's so ridiculous.
Houston's one. I never want to go up against Calvin Sampson. But is Sean Miller, is he still at Arizona?
No. Tommy Lloyd, who came from Gonzaga.
I'm old, man.
Yeah. Tommy Lloyd's got Arizona.
Yeah.
Rolling. So anyway,
and for those of you who don't know, like, what Steve's talking about with Iowa State is quite impressive, because you guys are not like an NIL. NIL is like the money bag powerhouse right now. Like, the fact that y'all are this good,
we're money balling.
You are exactly just like your namesake. It's insane.
This shirt is from 2 years ago. I was at the championship game in Kansas City, and we won. We beat Houston by like over 30 points. They were number one in the nation. It was the largest victory over number one team in history.
And Houston's like always nice, always.
If we win the championship tomorrow, then we'll have won 6 of the last 12 Big 12 championships.
So you guys are going to be a one seed then, you think?
That's pretty amazing. No, there's no way we'll be one.
Even if you win the Big 12 tournament, you won't be a one seed.
Correct.
How's that possible?
Well, I mean, there's a small chance.
Okay.
We're likely a two seed.
But if you take out Arizona,
we could slip to a three seed if we lose tonight.
That's crazy.
Like, Michigan State, Illinois, Iowa State, Houston are all like right in there.
All right. Well,
it would be hard to like, it's not like definitive. Anyway, we'll see.
Yeah.
How are we doing on time?
Illinois good?
Yeah.
How's Illinois doing? You said
esports got.
Oh, yeah.
Illinois?
Yeah, Urbana-Champaign.
Your school.
Your school is right in there with mine. Yeah.
Good on them,
wait,
yeah.
That's not the. Is that the same Illinois?
It is.
It is.
Urbana-Champaign. Yep.
But so that's like the University of Illinois is University of Illinois.
Well, there's Chicago and other, but yeah. Urbana-Champaign is like
that's like the main one.
The main one.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, you guys are good.
It's where DK and Mark Andreessen came from. Who else? What are other famous Tech alum?
Oh, Tech. I thought you were going to go. Playboy guy, I think, was from there.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Hugh Hefner, right?
We had DK, Mark Andreessen, Hugh Hefner, SBF.
I don't think we rep SBF. Max Levchin.
Okay.
A good one. Yeah.
There we go. Cool. We got all kinds of exciting stuff to talk today. Like, why was I flying in at 2 a.m.? I was in New York.
Oh,
we got all kinds of comments.
We got all kinds of PBJ now with more ASMR. I think that was when you were eating in the
That's right. I can't read it. Read it to me. What do you got?
DK's eyes are glazing over, and there's lots of laughter.
Jack, Steve. Everyone thinks you look Jack, Steve. Like, you do. You've been working out. So this 2 pounds looks like 2 pounds of muscle.
That's 2 pounds of muscle, yeah. Right exactly. At the top.
I did do some daily push-ups in New York.
There you go. Yeah, finger red number one, finger red number one, finger red number one. Maxi Madness. DK's eyes are glazing over. Vinny's laughing, and Matt is telling them, don't encourage them, DK. So.
he wants me to call, lay the law down. Let's talk about some Bitcoin or AI stuff.
I just want to know.
Let's do it.
Well, before we do we have that one guy who is apparently both a major Bitcoiner and an Iowa State fan? Because if that one guy is there now, he's
oh yeah, the YouTube commenter.
Show yourself.
I'm very loved, man. Tell me your prediction for tonight.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, yeah. So I was in New York. Well, the Spiral team had an in-person retreat. We do a couple a year. This is our first of the year. Always, we have our team, a lot of love between, you know, everyone on our teams. It's great to see each other in person. We had great discussions. One thing that Haley had a great idea to do in New York is hold a builder event, right? We've been doing it for like, I think, 9 straight months here. The Genesis idea came on this pod.
This very pod.
Several other cities have sprouted about doing builders, but New York hasn't. So Haley's like, let's do a builder. So Matt Velez and Haley and I hosted Builder New York.
At PubKey.
Nice. So it's fun. Thomas of PubKey has a podcast that they... I didn't know it either. Huh? But have you been to PubKey?
Never been. No. I haven't been to
New York. And I'm guessing DK has not been to PubKey?
I haven't been, no.
So when you're in New York, definitely go to PubKey. You go in, there's three rooms of significance. The first one is like a classic New York dive bar.
Yeah.
If just, and normal folks go in here. Like, and they probably don't know it's a Bitcoin bar. Mm. Unless you look pretty closely and then you see some Satoshi like shrine stuff. You go to the, or memorabilia. Then if you go to the back room, that's where there's more full-on like Bitcoin.
Dianetics.
A little bit more like here.
Yeah.
Well, actually harder core than here. But, and then there's another room where it is full-on shrine.
Yeah. Okay.
Was that the podcast room?
Yeah, that's the podcast room. Okay. So you had commented, DK, that you like the chaos and stuff and the colors and the chaos. And that's definitely true. And I don't know if you noticed, but on the wall in the background, they have people signing their names. Like visitors.
Oh, okay.
So Haley, Matt, and I sent her names, and there's hundreds of names assigned there. So that's cool. Anyway, we did a pod.
Yeah.
We mainly talked about Builder and PB. Mm-hmm. Then we did Builder. So we had at least 50 people come.
Nice.
I don't even know the count because like in the room that the main room we were presenting in, it was like it holds 50 and it was packed, and then there's like a separate room behind it, and I don't know how many people are in there, but at least 50 people.
Nice.
They're like 90 plus RSVPs. So,
was it pretty similar format to how we've done them in SF, or did they kind of vary a bit?
Similar. We had 4 presentations. So, I went first and presented Unleash the Agents. Which I'll have to present here or to you guys, or but it's about agentic commerce and you know, why it's going to be big, what are the different payment options, sort of, you know, credit cards, like TradFi 2.0, stablecoins, and Bitcoin. Makes the case for Bitcoin, but it addresses all of them. So I spent Matt Velez put the presentation together. No one thought I could do it in 20 minutes. I did it in 20 minutes. Very proud of myself.
All right.
I did it in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
First rehearsal was over an hour. So,
oh,
no, it was good. So cover that. And then Nick Slaney came.
Nice. Yeah, I saw that.
So I guess we're going to, this will be the 8th straight episode talking about MDK, I guess.
Wait, what was his bot's name again? Is it Ori? Is it Ori? Nick? Ori?
I'm receiving feedback from folks that like it is quite the streak.
Yeah.
But anyway, Nick came, gave like a good 5-minute prezo, and you guys probably saw he created the prezo like a few hours before and had Satbot created for him.
Yeah, I saw that.
It went well. Then Matt Velez gave a quick 5-minute prezo, just a few of the things he's built that are related to agentic commerce and Bitcoin payments. And then Elias from the Spiral team, an engineer on the Spiral team, demonstrated what he's been vibe coding, and a really cool knowledge search for Bitcoin technical stuff that has like an agentic interface and pretty powerful. So the only difference, like we wanted to get to those presentations and then open it up. So we didn't really get much audience engagement during the presentations, but we were actually, unlike every other builder we've done, we kept it like on clock, you know, on the clock.
And we're usually pretty good here too.
Every presentation we have takes twice as long as we budget for. And that's not a knock. It's usually because there's great audience engagement. So it's not bad. It's just then we run out of time for other stuff. Here we had, a good 45 minutes left. We got to the presentation in 45. We had 45 minutes of discussion, and it was great discussion. Lots of engagement.
Yeah.
Good. There's good pushback. You know, some people pushing on stablecoins, pushing back on, you know, why will Bitcoin be adopted instead of credit cards and stablecoins. So it was really, really good. There? Sorry.
Was Druckenmiller there? He was.
I was hoping Jeremy Allaire would show up, but did not. As far as I know, maybe he's in the back room. Anyway, and then another goal beyond just putting on a good event and getting good engagement was to find one or more people who want to continue it in New York.
Oh yeah, exactly.
And Haley and I had at least half a dozen people approach us afterwards, and it looks it looks promising.
That's great.
That we'll get someone.
So we've obviously talked a lot about agentic commerce on the show. I mean, I think at this point, it's like the Presidio agent payment show. What, if anything, was a new insight for you, or did you change your mind on, or was there anything that jumped out at you as like a new, a new idea or a new takeaway?
Not really. I mean, the main thing is we have put effort into putting this presentation together. I mean, this is something we've talked about on the show for a year.
Yeah.
And I've always felt it's a bit hand wavy. Or when I say it's hand wavy, meaning any of us can make a strong argument. Anyone at Presidio Bitcoin and anyone in Bitcoin can make a strong argument long term.
Sure.
Why is Bitcoin the best money?
Right.
Why is it the most neutral and credible and blah, blah, blah. But it's much harder to make the argument for like, why now?
Mm-hmm.
Why should a normal person use it now versus stablecoins or credit cards or whatever? It's a way harder argument.
Same for
you. So when I say we've been a bit hand wavy, we don't have like a super strong, tight argument, mm-hmm. but we've been developing it on the show and in other venues. And then with Matt Bliss putting this presentation together, I was going to get up in front of people and present it. We really wanted to make the best case. So I think that has strengthened over time. So that's mm-hmm. good news. But I'd still like to see it stronger. The why now still needs to be stronger. I mean, I still think the default scenario right now is that credit cards are going to, unless there's stuff that we find that they simply don't work.
Yeah.
That's going to be the default. That's going to be used. And then clearly the stablecoin, coin corps are going to push
right.
their solutions. So, there's likely going to be adoption there. And they solve some of the problems of credit cards.
Yeah.
Some of the problems that Bitcoin solves as well. So I still think we have a lot of work to do on that. But
cool.
The best thing we can do, though, is build, demonstrate.
Absolutely.
Cast your vote. That's one thing I say it because that's one of the slides in the presentation is like every payment made you can think of as a vote. So if you're a seller or a buyer, mm-hmm. if you're selling something, like, or you got your buddy selling you, tea or whatever.
Honey,
tea, what,
Yeah, you see the case, we were at 100K.
Every payment they accept.
Right.
Or if they just decide to accept Bitcoin, that's kind of a vote. But then every payment they accept is a vote. And if we're buying stuff, every payment we make in Bitcoin is a vote.
Right.
Yeah.
Did I'm curious, did Nick have anything? I actually didn't look at his presentation in the chat. Did he have anything new or of interest that you were surprised by? And what was the audience's reaction? Like, had people tried Oribot? Were they excited to try a chatbot interface? Like, was the audience like pretty AI build, or was this, I don't know how much of a bubble we're in here in San Francisco.
The audience, I think it was mostly Bitcoiners/crypto folks.
Yeah.
Nick did a nice job presenting. He covered, MDK and Ori, and then the unhuman stuff.
Yeah.
So the stuff we already know.
Yeah.
But he nicely covered all of it in like less than 6 minutes. So the audience, during the presentations there was no engagement or no questions or whatever. So at the end, it was mainly about just the general topic of agentic payments.
Yeah.
I don't think there was much on his stuff. I mean, he certainly engaged in the discussion though and responded. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the audience, one of the questions is like, do people even think agentic payments? I mean, clearly there's a lot of hype around it the last 2 months.
Right.
Like last year when I asked AI people, payments wasn't even on the radar.
Right.
And the last 2 months, it's like dramatically changed in terms of hype.
Yeah, for sure.
But then the question still remains. Yeah, I mean, the question is still, I mean, that includes us, right? I mean, we're excited about the hype, but it still remains a question. Is it really taking off this year or soon? Or is it hyped now and 10 years away? But the audience thought it is real.
And so I want to come back to that question, what's real, what's not. But on the audience in particular, did you get the sense, even without agentic payments, like were people that came to this, you know, outside of our bubble, were they already vibe coding? Had they, you know, for example, set up an OpenClaw before, or had they used Replit or Cloud Code or something like Oribot? Or is this like, oh, a new world they wanted to try?
I don't think anyone asked that. Mm-hmm. But my intuition says yes, that people a lot of them had. But maybe not trying agentic payments, I'm not sure.
So on that point about what's real, what's not, I mean, I think I saw one of you guys or someone, maybe it was Asha, I don't know, someone shared in our chat that, you know, trying to see what was hype versus what was real in agentic payments. DK, maybe that was you. Like, what is y'all's sense right now? Like, obviously, everyone and their sister is talking about agent payments. Like, what is y'all's general feeling of, like, has anyone proven a use case for this yet? Is it still just, like, theoretical? Obviously, OpenClaw opened up
shared something that kind of indicated that even I think X402, which claims very large volume, is maybe not as legit volume in use cases as maybe the perception may be ahead of reality there.
Yeah, I think it's still very much speculation, but I am quite bullish on agentic payments. Just the whole, just what we have experienced with having an agent do stuff for you.
Yeah.
And then buy. I mean, this is like obvious. And the example we give in the presentation that I presented was, you know, buying a pair of shoes, right? Something relatable for everyone. So it's not some like super weird use case.
Not like mailing a potato or something.
Dude, I love that.
You know, buying a pair of shoes. So everyone buys a pair of shoes. And there's a range, you know, some people just like put no effort into it and just click buy or go to a store and say they look nice and buy it. Others do a bunch of research. Others do a lot of price comparison, but no matter who you are, like if you just tell your agent who already knows about you and stuff, and it just like does all that work for you in a matter of seconds and purchases it for you, mm-hmm. and they just arrive, like why would you not do that?
Right, of course.
and maybe they're using, you know, maybe you're using a credit card to do that.
Right.
But the notion of agentic payments seems obvious to me. And then of course, then there are novel use cases as well, which are naturally speculative, but just traditional online retail, there's no question in my mind agentic commerce will be a thing soon.
Yeah.
And because already a behavior I've developed, I'm not having the agent buy it for me, but I definitely do product research via AI now. And it is far superior to just Googling. And so I bought a number of things where I start with AI. It seems to find really good stuff. Since I'm still trying to develop trust, or, you know, trusting it, I then do my more traditional research with those products and stuff to see, like, are they actually good? And, like, I've been impressed so far. And then I manually buy it. Mm. But yeah, if I can, like, one click or basically zero click buy, why would I not do that?
Totally.
I think that's the future, but I am concerned about, it feels like there's a popular narrative that somehow ads as a format are going to work really well. And these like LLM workflows, and I think I'm kind of like default a little skeptical of that because they're so good and the information is so crafted toward what you actually want. It doesn't, like, ads work when there's a little bit of like an arbitrage of attention between, hey, here's what we think you might like, and here's some other options that are paid, like the kind of the standard Google web search model. But I think when you move toward like an LLM giving you really high quality research, it almost feels like you lose some of the ability for there to be a ad monetization event there. So I think I'm kind of generally skeptical of how those things fit in. I'm optimistic that there's going to be a lot of opportunity in agentic commerce from like agents doing commerce with each other or on behalf of us, but not necessarily around fitting into that flow of like traditional commerce categories.
But that's separate though. Like I don't need to... If I use AI and there's no ads, I can do exactly what I just said. I can still have the agent do my product research and then buy it for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I, I agree with that, but I'm interested in your thoughts on the ads here. So why is it your understanding that, like, right now, let's say I was using OpenAI or something, ChatGPT, and I was going to have it buy something, you know, is the ad right now just being displayed, or is the plan just to display it in the answer, or are they already experimenting with, hey, if we're going to, like, one click buy this for you, we're just going to, like, buy us and wait towards who's paying us on the back end? And if that's the case, that seems like extremely against the user's best interest, and something that's also really hard to audit, and, like, something I mean, you already know my thoughts on this, but I certainly wouldn't use that even more than I already think.
Right. But it seems like if you are compromising with a back end payment from somebody and you're not giving the thing that's best for the user, you're actually hurting the whole LLM experience to the point that you might actually lose trust that way.
Well, isn't that true for Google too, though?
No, because I think Google is different because there's a world where there's the ability to arbitrage the person's attention on the search results page. The search results page says, hey, here's some stuff that we think is good. Here's some stuff that we're paid for that might be good too. And it's, like, up to you to pick. So it's presented as, like, we don't really know. But in LLMs, it's presented as, you want these things, you want the very best five things, here's the best five, right?
So I don't think I'm seeing ads, and I hope I don't see ads. I am paying a monthly subscription, so I hope that would mean that I can be using a product that is ad-free. Or, you know, hopefully there's not just Google dominance, right? Hopefully there's several really good options, and maybe some have ads and others don't.
Yeah.
But it would be a very sad day, I think, if there's only one company and there's ads and it degrades the experience.
Yeah, I don't see that ever happening. And the good reason is, I mean, as long as we have the open source models, like, there, I mean, look, it's always been challenging for me, right? Because I understand Google is, like, arguably the greatest business of all time. And I've wondered my entire life who clicks these ads. I've never clicked a Google ad that I know of in my entire life. So I presume I see the revenue numbers that people do click these ads. It's hard for me to empathize, but, like, I guess they're there. But but when it comes to the agentic commerce thing,
DK worked on this in, like, 2003. So
yeah,
let's actually get to the truth. Is it all a lie?
Max, exactly. If you had to go replace that wig, how would you do that?
If I wanted to replace what?
Your wig.
Oh, no mames, man. Well, first, I would have to buy the Whoopi Goldberg mask that we had from the PBJ view. I would start there, to be clear, this was the whole view. I mean, I've talked to you guys about that company that I love, Coggy, which the whole view for them was, like, look, you know, and if you go back to Larry and Sergey's original paper, they even spell it out in there. They say, you know, the moment you introduce advertisement, like, it's you know, it's a long march toward death, because it's like the frog boiling. Like, I understand your point, the arbitrage, as long as you can show two options of, like, just the pure best result and the ad, then, you know, it's not going from zero to, like, horrible. It's like a slight degree, you know, shift, but, like, there's still limited attention in ad space, right? So, you know, let's say you're looking for the best answer, and you start with the 10 best answers. Then you say, well, it's the 9 best answers and 1 promoted, and then the 8 best answers and 2 promoted. Mm-hmm. Like, over time, that experience still gets worse and worse, which I would argue up until the LLM boom was what people were writing about, was sort of, like, the Internetification of Google. Like, I stopped using Google before the LLM boom and was starting to use things like Coggy. But now that we're getting the LLMs, I'm going back to the LLMs. But
quick story on that, actually. Yeah. 21 years ago, 2005, I was at Yahoo Search.
Special number.
I was on the Yahoo
You
search
were Yahoo?
It was my MBA internship.
Were either of you guys a dog
but
pile?
But it was two.
Ask Jeeves?
Yeah. But 2005, Yahoo was still, like, a power. Mm-hmm. Like, I think people in Silicon Valley knew that Google was going to, like, dominate, but the rest of the world, I don't think, didn't. Anyway, but yeah, so from being in the inside there, Yahoo showed a ton of ads in the search results page, and Google showed far fewer. And I saw the internal debates there. It was, like, basically next to impossible for them to reduce the number of ads they showed. Because they were having discussion, like, how do we gain market share on Google? Well, one, it's to create a better user experience, show less ads. So why? Well, because you can 100% with 100% certainty quantify the revenue loss that quarter if you remove ads. and you can't quantify, or it's way more difficult. It's a leap of faith, like how much market share is this going to give us by improving the UX?
And Yahoo is already a public company at this point.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So, and sadly, now Google shows probably even more ads than Yahoo did at the time. It's insane how many ads are shown now on a Google search results page.
Yeah. It'd be interesting for someone. I don't know like what kind of revenue Yahoo is doing, but it'd be cool to like maybe buy Yahoo and bring it back.
Like, do you want to personally just chip in, or are we passing the hat or what?
Yeah, exactly. I'm gonna pass that one to you, DK, but I'll it couldn't be that much, but I am very curious about where this is going to go in the long run, because and also what I remember in the early days of Google is you also had I'm Feeling Lucky, right? Which was just like, I click one thing and I get the best answer. So to be clear,
that's basically from the vision of what an LLM is.
That's what I'm saying. Like you go back and listen to Larry, talk in like 99, like he was ready for AI and LLMs
This is an AI company. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And like that dude was just like right. And like probably doesn't get nearly enough respect for like all of his vision over the years. But I'm curious, you guys were there around this time. Like, so in that world, both he and Sergey acknowledged in their paper that ads were eventually going to make the product bad. Ads happened to work very well. He clearly wants it to be a one-shot AI company. Like what were their other ideas for monetization? And like, are some of those going to come back in the, the LLM wave?
Well, they had several. I think there were three that were in the venture pitch, which was kind of early.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'll get them all right, but there was the Google search appliance was one of their ideas for how to make money. It was to sell basically enterprise search.
I thought it was like an oven in your house.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a reasonable line of business that eventually kicked off what is now, Google Workspace and all the, enterprise cloud stuff. So it's kind of like a little bit of genesis there.
Well, what's funny about that, or sorry to interrupt, but when I joined Google, I was blown away by how horrible enterprise search was at Google. It was like impossible to find stuff.
How was that information? Possible? If they have an incredible,
it was horrible. Enterprise search was horrible.
How does it get worse?
And so, and then
because the thing that makes Google great is because it has the whole web cached in memory.
Right.
And so you have tons of interconnect between pages, referencing pages and information linkages and in terms in an enterprise doesn't have that much content and doesn't have that much interlinking. So if you isolate the index to just all the stuff contained within an enterprise, you actually don't have enough signal to build a really great search, even if you use the same algorithm.
And the irony is, I guess back then that's the case, is like you actually still needed to like be on the web to get that value. Now you can potentially with LLMs, you can condense that value from the web and then potentially transfer it with fine tuning or something just to the enterprise. So it would work much better now.
Yeah. 100%, yeah. That'd be a great, And I think that there's a bunch of companies doing stuff like that. Like, I think Glean does stuff like that. They're really good.
Yeah.
Okay, back to your list, DK.
Yeah, back to your list.
What's number two and three?
There was the search, the ads. Like, there was enterprise search, there was ads, and then I think site search was the third one, which was if you owned a web property and you wanted to enable public search on your web property, you could pay, Google to basically run software as a service, like search as a software service.
Mm.
And, if you run, like I guess the vision today would be like if Amazon were to outsource their search engine to Google and make the public search box on Amazon powered by Google. I think that was called site search at the time. I think that was the third line of business that was contemplated.
But like AdSense was not part of the original DC deck?
I don't think so.
Isn't the history, Yahoo bought, like Overture was created and was the genesis of the AdSense type ad model. Yahoo bought them and then Google created their own, created AdSense in-house?
Well,
is that accurate?
Yeah, AdWords was the closest equivalent, I'd say. And then AdSense was more like for looking at different publisher properties and serving ads, not against necessarily like keyword queries, but against publisher properties. So you could have AdSense for like a blog. You could have AdSense for domains in case you typed in the domain that, wanted to serve a relevant ad. But the kind of contextual understanding of what is going on and putting up a keyword targeted ad based on that concept was at least that's my recollection of AdSense, not really part of the venture pitch.
So do you guys remember when it became clear that ads was like the runaway business? But like when y'all were there, like was that clear at that point, or was it still?
It was very clear.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Internally though, but they tried to not make a big deal out of it because you didn't want to invite competition.
Interesting.
Like very Microsoft. Interesting.
So how do you think that translates? So obviously they knew in the long run though, they knew that would definitely insidify the product in the long run. Now we're entering into a new age. You know, some people are hyped on ads. I tend to agree with you. Like, I mean, again, but it's hard for me to evaluate these things because I know for me as a user, I was willing to pay for Kagi in the first place, right? So there's no world in which I'm going to use an ad product for my search. And if I had to, then like, I'm increasingly bullish on open source models running on stuff like Maple or Vora or whatever. And that's really exciting to me. But like, I also understand most people shouldn't go with the default. So, I mean, as long as the LLM is showing you responses, you could, in theory, still have like, hey, here's some, suggested things, or like, here's some links. By the way, this hyperlink is an ad and like, whatever, tell people about that. But as you start having the LLM become, or the AI become more agentic and just doing stuff on your behalf, then yeah, essentially, like if it's going to buy something, it either they get a cut back or they don't. And if they do, how do they show that to you? And how do you audit that? Like, where do you see the business models going? Well,
so we already have subscription, right?
Which I would love if that's the way that web works.
I have a question about that, but real quick. And then you can imagine taking a cut of e-commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's ads. So do either of you know the data on subscriptions? Like what percentage of OpenAI or Google?
That's a good question.
Or Anthropic users are using free versus upgrading to a subscription? And is it, does it skew, and how does it compare to historical services? But in any case, what's definitely true, like with search, there's no subscription. Or I mean, like no one's paying a subscription for search.
Well, I mean, the nerds on Hacker News were starting to, and there was 40,000 of us, but yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, no one.
Yes.
I mean, it's a rounding error, I don't know what the data is for.
Yeah,
Claude and ChatGPT, but it's more than 40,000 people are paying $20 a month.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think it's encouraging because it is changing people's behavior. Because I think rationally, if you were forced, like most people have used Google for free, mm-hmm. but if you were forced to say, hey, you're going to pay $100 a year subscription for Google, or it's taken away. You can't search the internet anymore.
Yeah.
Is that going to change behavior? If that actually was the proposition, of course, tons of people would subscribe. But because of the ad model and they make so much money, they weren't forced to do that. And so we're just stuck in this world of like almost everything with the ad model. I think it's a way healthier environment if there's many competing models.
Yep.
And so I think
remember the dawn of the internet, there was no concept of like putting your credit card into a website.
Yeah.
Right. So like that you needed HTTPS and then you needed SSL, you needed a whole ecosystem of people getting comfortable with that. I mean, that was Amazon's biggest fight for so long was you got to put your credit card into a website. That's bonkers.
Yeah. I still think it's bonkers.
And so people, but you said, and you also, not only the technology, but like you said, people had to get comfortable. So it's the same like psychologically, and here is psychological too. If stuff's given to you for free, it's a big leap to start paying for it. Even if in the end, if you started doing it, you'd be like, oh, I like the trade-off.
Right.
To change behavior is hard, but I think people paying subscriptions for AI, there's so much value there.
Yeah.
That's changing behavior, and that's going to be good for all kinds of future services that people are comfortable paying.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. The good news is we should definitely pull this data, but anecdotally in my own life and everyone I know, like even though I did pay, for Kagi before and a few other things, like eventually I was many years refusing even to pay for like Spotify or whatever, but mm-hmm. But now I have multiple LLMs and I'm paying to the point where I'm like, shit, how do I cancel this stuff? Like this got out of control way too quickly. And yep. And I like everyone I know is paying for at least one. Multiple people are paying for many. So there's no question that the sort of like Overton window of like, hey, is the web free or not is shift up. And that seems to me generally a positive thing. Having said that, I mean, something we've talked a lot about on the show as well is like that also is dangerous in the sense that it creates like a very two-tiered world very quickly. It's like there are those people that can pay and then those who can't. And like, if you're in, you know, developing world or whatever, now to be fair, I mean, just like Spotify and stuff, I'm sure they'll price it differently.
And it raises the open versus closed model discussion. And if that gap closes, then it makes it more accessible to people.
And it's also, and it kind of comes back to this idea for me, I think we talked about 1 or 2 weeks ago, where it's like, you should always have the open router or whatever, where you can go and say, let me just, even if it's just to test every once in a while, lots of queries to see what the responses are. Because one thing I'm concerned about is, you know, as I was telling DK in our chat this morning, none of these companies, I don't trust any of these companies. Some of them I really don't trust. And, you know, on principle, I don't want to get hooked in their ecosystem, even if it's very good at first, because I know that trick. It's like Sapbot always does in our chat, where he does that little emoji where there's like cheese in a box and he has a little stick holding it up. It's like, bro, I'm not eating your cheese. I don't care how good that cheese is. You're going to pull the stick on me. I know it. And, you know, that's why it's so important. We have, you know, even if the web kind of goes this way where a few big providers are getting you to pay for it, it seems good at first. Like, you have to have that open stack of, you know, open source models, ideally Bitcoin payment rails, et cetera. Because otherwise, yeah, we're all just going to end up at the box eating our cheese and, you know.
Yeah, so I wonder how it'll play out. Because like with search, I mean, there are a number, you know, you mentioned what, Excite and stuff. And AltaVista was like the big one in 98, 99.
Ask Jeeves and Dogpile. Those are my go-tos.
And then, Google is so transformational that, you know, it won and then it's still winning today, right? And there's really not been competition in the search space. But if you look at other things like internet browsers, that was a little more dynamic. Started with Netscape, IE, then crushed them.
And Chrome crushed them.
Well, and at the time though, it just seemed like IE was going to be like Google, where like for 30 years or whatever, it's just going to be IE. And then Firefox actually was able to eat some market share. And Google helped it a lot with generating revenue for Firefox. But then Chrome launched and then it dominated. And Safari has a lot of market share too. So it's definitely a healthier market compared to search.
Yeah.
So maybe that's a good analogy for how these big AI models will play out. And there just won't be one dominant one. It'll be kind of like it is today. And they are jockeying for position, right? I mean, ChatGPT had most of the market share, but Gemini is like really encroaching on it now.
And then
Claude is just, Opus models are
insane.
Really, really, really good.
I also, just as a pause point, I mean, DK, on last week's show, you got me thinking more about using Anthropic as Claude as a sort of thought partner, because I was primarily using Gemini's Melee driver. And I was using for building stuff, which I'm, you know, probably doing less than you are, but I was using Oribot, which is a wrapped Claude. But I've started using Claude as my like chatting partner and research partner. Yeah. And I'm using, as of right now, only because I first need to get one of my domains. By the way, remember how we were talking about, oh, it's so genius with Replit. You just like buy a domain. It's so easy. Well, now, you know, I've got hosting through them and I can't figure out how to damn transfer, you know, my domain. So I want to get my $20 a month out of them so I can, you know, before I add one more subscription to the pie. Of course, it's a genius model, but they gave me some cheese and now I'm in a box. but I have to just say, I don't know what is going on over at Anthropic, because they clearly have less money than Google and OpenAI. They have a lot of money. But like, those guys can cook. That it is the best, as of right now, for me doing research. It is, 2 or 3 months ago, Google trounced everything I'd ever use. This is now trouncing Google. Unbelievable. Like, in helping me write out some of my essays to the first time. And I actually, something else I want to be very careful about, as we talked about, is like, I love writing for the actual thinking of it. And, you know, I plan to continue to always do that. But for the first time, I had Anthropic write an essay and I was like, part of this is better than I would have done.
I would never think about having Anthropic write the essay, but it can be a thought partner, a brainstorm partner. Totally. Like, I think if you say, look, I'm going all organic, I'm not touching these tools ever, you're going to get left behind. Your stuff, it's going to take you too long, you're going to spend so much time. But if you also just throw up an idea and say, whatever it outputs I'm posting, that's also kind of a garbage approach. I think the only rational approach is to know how to use the tool and get the most out of it. But don't just put all of your trust in the tool and don't avoid the tool. Use it to help you.
Totally. And I'm finding that balance right now. But to me, at least, this was a a mark. And again, there were other things where it's still, I was like, okay, I would have done this very differently. And obviously I'm still using it as a thought partner, but it was the first time I've ever read something where I was like, wow, that's just incredible.
So if I may switch gears a little bit.
Yeah.
We'll still talk about AI, but a different angle. Like typically we're talking about AI in ways that most of the products we talk about are proprietary products.
Right.
ChatGPT, Anthropic, Replit, etc. Closed source, proprietary products, and they're really good. They're really good products. Obviously, we care very much about open source, open models, etc. So, I'd love to talk about what are our thoughts on like open source AI, and not just the models, but all the tooling around it,
yeah,
and the experiences around it. Protocols, the whole stack, everything about AI. What are our thoughts on open source? And then more specifically, I certainly expect the big AI labs to do a lot of open source as well,
mm-hmm.
when it's strategic for them.
Of course. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what'll be the gaps? What'll be the blind spots where there'd be a lot of value to have open source AI that the big AI labs aren't doing and VC-funded startups aren't doing. Curious to open that up. And I asked that actually for selfish reasons as well. Like, should Spiral start funding open source?
It sounds like Steve's got his checkbook open.
Our checkbook might be open. So what should Spiral be thinking about for open source AI funding?
Jeez, it's a great great broad open question. I think with open source stuff, a lot of times I think it's comfortable to build an open source version of something that we know gives us value as a closed source tool, and then we start comparing it and saying, yeah, but it's open. And I get I get why it's an attractive proposition to do the open version of the thing that's closed. But I think the place where open source often shines is when it sort of moves up or down a layer or figures out sort of a different use case that's maybe not well served and can't really be well served because of a structural problem with either, you know, how the product or service is delivered by the closed source version, or, you know, the business model of the closed source version. It's just sort of something that it's almost like a judo move where it hurts the ability to become more open. Like the closed source thing can't become more open. So I think I was thinking about this a bit more, and I think like a good analogy, which I think I've talked to you guys about before, definitely written about, is, you know, when Linux first came out, you know, we all said, oh good, Linux is going to replace Windows. So I had my tower desktop computer in college and I installed Linux and I was like using some crappy Windows manager and like, you know, using Linux, but it was kind of like a bad version of Windows. Like, it didn't have the software I wanted, didn't have the ecosystem. It was open, which was nice, but it sort of missed on all of the things that mattered. And the real winning move for Linux was to help us scale cloud services like Google and Facebook, and basically every, you know, Salesforce, every cloud service you use today wouldn't work if you had to pay licensing fees to Sun Solaris. But it does work when you have an open, free operating system.
And Android,
yeah. So I think, like, you know, rebuilding the closed thing at that same layer is kind of a peer or cousin to the closed thing. It's fine starting point, but I think that's not really ever where the magic is. The magic is up a layer, down a layer, on the side somehow.
What new markets does it enable? DK, could you go a little bit deeper in that? Because you talked about this many times over the last couple of years. Why is it that Linux opened up the cloud market? So you're saying the alternative was for these big, whatever, Facebook or Google, they would have to pay another company large fees. But why wouldn't there still be competition, even if there's whatever closed source? Okay, someone else develops, you know, whatever, another closed source alternative that's cheaper.
Like, it would be like why was Linux so powerful? And the operating system were coupled, so mm-hmm. you'd deploy your, you know, your web server on Sun with Solaris, and that would like that
on
you'd buy that
Spark chips too.
Yeah, right.
There was more diversity in chips back then.
Okay. Yeah, and so Sun Microsystem. You guys are getting into like ancient history. Right now. Sorry. Yeah.
So think about Linux. You just run on.
We're
going
to go back to cuneiform.
Yep.
Okay.
Right. Like Linux, you can just run on any, you can compile it for any x86 chip. So you can buy it from Intel or AMD or whoever. Those are kind of commodity parts and they're not super specialized. And so the magic is you sort of commoditize the complement, you know, the famous Joel Spolsky. You sort of, if the chips are all commodity, then the OS kind of has more space to play. And the Spark chips are not commodity, but the Intel x86 chips were quickly becoming commodity.
Like at the time, if you had a company and you wanted to equip people with computers, right, you'd buy an IBM RS6000 or a Spark station. Or if you're doing like graphics or whatever, then you'd buy SGI computers. And everything was proprietary about them.
Interesting. So why didn't we see who was making who was commoditizing the chip, or like who was making the chip really cheap at that point?
Google was huge here.
And the hardware too?
But they were able to take just off the shelf.
Got it.
x86 computers and like PCs basically.
Got it. Oh, really?
And Linux.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
At the time, I think most people thought that was insane because it's like like a dinky little home computer, you're going to do big iron stuff.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, that's where a lot of early innovation from Google internally was actually being able to scale out.
Wow.
There was a lot of innovation around distributed computing.
Exactly. Google. Okay. Interesting. And they were literally buying off the shelf.
Networking works differently. And you need to assume the thing is going to fail. So you need to have like a whole, operational process at the network operation center to say there's going to be people who run in and pull these things out when they fail and put in new ones, because it happens very frequently. These are just like off the shelf components. They're extremely cheap, but they require all kinds of other trade-offs to be able to make it actually operate well.
Interesting.
Both hardware, software, operations, everything.
And so was it Google's plan always at that point of like, hey, because Linux is open, we're going to sort of like modify and continue to build this out for our needs? Or did they ever think, or like, was there ever like a proprietary push, or were they always going to build on top of the open?
I guess it was not ideological. I think it was just practical. It was like, well, we've got these things running, we can run them. Well, what's more of these?
Also early on, Google is making a ton of money off search. So like, why invest in building their own hardware? Mm-hmm. Why build proprietary software? That wasn't the core business. It was better to let the world adopt what Google had done well with these open systems, because that just meant more internet usage, more searching, more revenue for Google.
Yeah. Well, the reason I'm pushing all this, by the way, is because I think it's really interesting to think from this stage of like, okay, Google, like, well, history rhymes. Like, what are the rhymes going to be this time around where there's, some entity, I actually have my own idea, which I didn't mean to skip too far ahead, but an entity which can basically use the open monetary stack, whether Bitcoin as a monetary good or the payment network or both, to like enable them to basically turbocharge their business. I mean, this is getting ahead of us, but the company I keep going back to is MicroStrategy. I mean, I guess Block is another one. But it's interesting. Like, it of course makes sense that someone that's making money somewhere else is going to probably use Bitcoin in a way to make a lot more money and cut their own costs. I've got some thoughts on that, but before I jump ahead to MicroStrategy, like, I don't know.
Yeah, I'd say that's more of a like financial engineering thing, and it has its place.
Sort of.
And I'm not dismissing it. I'm generally enthusiastic that it exists, but I don't think it really moves the technology forward in a major way. It's not like a new open source technology idea, right? Which I think is where we were starting to.
Yeah, and I think we should go more in that direction. Although I'm increasingly questioning that, because I actually think that MicroStrategy mooning Bitcoin's price first might be like the unlock we need for people to start using it in other ways too. But yeah, I'm curious here where you're thinking on more of the technological stack.
Let me share some possible characteristics,
yeah,
and then that might help generate some ideas from you guys. For what makes good candidates for people to invest in working on open source projects for AI, one is if it's non-commercial, meaning it's software that is expected to be high impact and really valuable to people, but or to agents, but there's no like obvious business model. It's not expected to generate revenue. And that's, you know, so that's less, that type of project is less likely to get VC funded, less likely to have startup, you know, hungry entrepreneurs to go after that, right, because there's no profit motive. Mm-hmm. So that's one characteristic. Another is, you know, projects that prioritize principles that we care about, that the Bitcoin community cares about, but apply to other spaces too. Mm-hmm. And that's like privacy, security, sort of on steroids, like hyper security, permissionless, mm-hmm, censorship resistance, etc. Those types of characteristics. Obviously there's like security companies that make a lot of money. I mean, so just, you know, building products with one or more of those doesn't mean you can't make money.
Right.
But oftentimes, if you're really pushing the extremes in those, it's marginal from a profit motivation. And so I think those apply to AI as well. So those are some other characteristics. But ultimately, it's like, what can you build of value that's in an open source project that's not going to get just steamrolled in 3 months,
right,
by the big, right, AI labs or by 50 Silicon Valley startups that are getting funded? Is the big question. I think one more characteristic too, there's like application level software, there's protocol. And I do think like if you get closer to protocol or infrastructure, that lends itself more to open source, non-commercial as well, versus where you're trying to capture and have direct engagement with a customer.
Yeah.
So that's another angle.
So I have a ton of thoughts on this. I mean, and I think one way I'm thinking about this is where open source can enable new business models, but like it's required that we have an open standard first. And in some cases, like sidestep, I mean, basically move into areas that closed companies may not or cannot. And so the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, I am following largely from hearing from, you know, Jesse and other folks in the office, how quick the open source models are catching up. So for example, you know, there's like the lawsuit from Claude, which I find kind of funny, Anthropic, being like, you guys are just using our model to distill your Chinese models. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, we probably just jacked all the internet too. So, like, you know, comes around, bro. But it's interesting to me that so far, you know, the commoditization of the compliment all coming from China, right? So all of the good open source models, Quinn and all of these guys, it's all Chinese. Now, you know, I've said once before that I am skeptical of all the closed American companies. I don't trust any of them. I certainly don't trust the Chinese models either, right? And so I am not at all convinced that these models don't have some kind of like poison pill in them. I know that sounds whatever, tinfoil hat, whatever. But we don't still fully understand how LLMs even work. So you can't, it's not like completely, what's the word for this? Like you don't know A always leads to B. What's the word for that? Anyways, it'll come back to me. But the point is, you can't distill and understand exactly what's happening within one of these models. So one thing that I would like to see is, at the very least, for a variety of reasons, we shouldn't let China just totally dominate the open source model world. I would love to see, and I know one or two companies have gotten funded on this, and Facebook in theory or Meta was working on this, but I would love to see more American companies that are distilling models. Ideally, we've talked about on the show before, my dream would be a model where you can actually see the entire data set of what went into the training. But even if not that, like, who's going to build the Quinn in America? That would be number one.
Well, real quick, actually, this should have been like a headline for our show today. NVIDIA, $26 billion commitment towards open models.
Really?
Open AI. They announced it this
week. Wait, open AI or like actually open AI?
I mean, it's like a press release, right?
But causation, yeah. Thank you.
I think it was a reaction to a lot of their customers are now, you know, threatening to create their own chips or use other people's chips as a negotiating tactic. So then NVIDIA is like, okay, we'll just put $26 billion towards creating open open models. We'll see how much it comes to reality. But
that's the real commoditize the compliment move.
But that's the answer. If they do that, that's the answer to your question.
Amazing. So that's one thing I want to see on the hardware chip level as well. You know, it would be incredible to have an alternative to NVIDIA that is an open stack. Like imagine in the same way that framework computer, you can like go in there and hack on every part. Imagine there was an alternative, basically, yeah, like GPU stack where like it's you know exactly all the parts in there and you can, you know, potentially plug and play as you wish. I think that would be very interesting. And then if you want to get really crazy, a company around this, like imagine someone that wants to build their own fab one day and it's all open like that, that obviously would have to be more commercial, but I think that's pretty interesting.
How do you get the capital to build the data centers and do all the research for an open version?
Well, I think you would have to turn that into a company at this stage. I don't see a way to do this like an open source project. Maybe you could start the research of like, hey, we're going to like open source the whatever CAD files or whatever that looks like. And then I think a company would probably have to commercialize it, is my guess. Or the government does it, right? It's like a public effort.
Well, that's why I find NVIDIA credible because you have, I mean, it's a you know, wildly profitable and valuable company.
Sized entity.
But I mean, it's realistic to me that they actually would spend that much money and genuinely produce open models because that's not their core business.
Yep. Yep.
So it actually is strategic to their business to do exactly that.
Yeah.
Kind of like just like Google gave away free stuff.
It's very Android, right?
Yeah.
It's very Android. Android.
Well, like, I mean, like in the Google Maps, when I worked on the product, we came out with turn-by-turn navigation and it completely upended that market. We just gave it away for free.
Yeah.
And it's in the interest of the
company. And I don't understand on the NVIDIA thing, what exactly are they committing the money to? Like to companies they want to invest in, open source projects? Like, have they talked about how the money will be spent at all? Or
No, I don't know. I don't think they did. And they could very well. It literally could have been just an immediate reaction to their business negotiations.
Well,
so it's probably TBD.
We should get the NVIDIA people back in here ASAP.
Yeah.
Which reminds me, I need to send an invite to an NVIDIA person for next week. So that's a good reminder. Another thing, though, that I think would be really important to work on from the open side is, well, two things. One is, I think, a very important primitive is auditability. And actually, auditability you could take in many different ways. One important piece we're missing in the compute stack today that unlocks a lot of the crazier ideas that we've discussed, including autonomous digital life, is being able to verify that a specific computation was performed as you believed it was going to be performed. So some people from the crypto land have been doing this with zero knowledge proofs or homomorphic encryption. But basically, this seems like something where Spiral could actually potentially move the needle, is funding research to be able to prove that, hey, I will pay you conditionally for a computation, but you need to be able to send me a proof that that specific computation was done. That's a big unlock. And that's like, I think you're right in y'all's wheelhouse.
Taking a note.
Yeah.
Taking notes. Yeah. Good.
So that's the first one. You should talk to Dustin on that too, because he's been thinking a lot about specifically how that could unlock some of the life stuff. The other big thing to me is like, someone needs to figure, and I think this could be commercialed as well. So I don't know what's open source, what's commercial. It's something I certainly want to back. But like payment standards to like move between, I mean, the internet's open, right? And so there's different jurisdictions. And like, you know, at some level, the product market fit for Bitcoin has always been, let's call it geographic arbitrage, right? Like allowing people from different worlds with different views, different legalities to cooperate. And so mm-hmm. I think the same thing is going to be true for AI. It's like, you know, if there are AIs from all different parts of the world with different laws, just like the internet, like even if there's different payment and whatever computation regulations in one country, like how do those guys work together and at large scale? I think figuring out standards for like using Bitcoin as collateral between different payment networks on the internet or different AIs, that's going to be very, very important. That could be a commercial opportunity as well. I think the commercial opportunity that I'm thinking a lot about there is who's going to build the bank for AIs, but that's coming. That's my big obsession at the moment. But first you need like a standard of like, how do agents post collateral between one another? And then that verifiability of compute, I post collateral, you say you did a computation. If it doesn't, it gets slashed. Those are all standards, which I think for open source developers.
For the latter one, are you thinking of like a peer-to-peer network for inference?
Yes. That's part of it. And that's where I think we're going, right? It's like a peer-to-peer network for anything. Inference could be one thing, you know, all the other digital resources we talked about, bandwidth, storage, whatever, but like different standards for, hey, I want to buy a resource. And like, if you don't have that resource, I know, like one of the key ideas is that agents can't fall back on state actors and using state violence to enforce their property rights. So how are they going to enforce property rights if someone violates at like the scale of 100,000 agents mm-hmm. working together? Well, one way to do that is collateral. And I think there needs to be a standard established for how Bitcoin is used as collateral in each of these bilateral agreements between agents.
Real quick, we have David can't see the comments, so I'll catch you up to speed. First of all, Ryan Brown 9900 says, love the basketball talk. So maybe sorry, guys, I'm getting encouragement to talk more about.
I just sit back. I let it happen.
He's like an hour and a half late. Like, what? Do you just hear in the park?
Let's see. Oh, so one like specific project idea would be a peer-to-peer network for inference, like an AI project.
I love that.
Now, this is not, I mean, there are already projects in this vein. Like Eric Voorhees started Venice. Have you followed that at all?
Yeah, but no shitcoin, please.
Well, that's so I'm not aware of a peer-to-peer network for inference that uses Bitcoin.
Well, actually, I have to give him a shout out. Christopher David from Open Agents just yesterday, I believe, relaunched his GPU marketplace using sort of Nostr as the communication layer. I don't know if I'm supposed to announce this, but that man came out of the blue and just raised some money from another Bitcoiner. So that hopefully will be announced soon. But,
all right,
but that's one example.
People need to listen to our show for confidential leaks, information.
I hope that wasn't too confidential.
Insider trading.
But I'll check out
openagents.com.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the only one I know of so far.
And then there's, is it Joseph Jacks? Is that the open source VC?
Isn't he
huge on
BitTensor?
Yeah. BitTensor, right? And it's in the same
vein. It's like, again, all these things have shit coins and like, it's completely like, it's like, how many of these damn cycles do we have to go through? But yes, in theory, BitTensor tries to solve, my understanding, at a very high level. So if you had this verifiability compute primitive we're talking about, you wouldn't even need that. But I think what they do is they have these like different subnets where it's like, okay, I want you to do, I don't know, like image generation or some task. And then I think they do some kind of like random sampling to see like, okay, is someone doing what they say they're going to do or not? And then there is staking in there with whatever their, you know, crap token is. I mean, like something like that with the zero knowledge proofs would be much better. But even like that with Bitcoin and none of the whatever tokenomics crap would be really promising to me.
Yeah, it's so frustrating to me.
So frustrating
that yet again, there's like a new project space.
I know.
And everyone has to go the shitcoin route.
Always.
Right. Why does no one see the obvious that just use Bitcoin as money?
Fund that. Let's do that. I want to fund that too.
Well, I think that's interesting to explore. Yeah. Explore that. By the way, just thinking more about, I mean, you're saying like, how do you know if they're doing the computation, or how do you know which model they're running and like do sampling, etc. That kind of reminds me of Bitcoin mining, actually, right? Because if I'm a pool and your miners connect to my pool, and I have to pay you out a portion of anything gets mined, how do I know you're actually doing the work that you're saying, right?
And it's much easier to do that with SHA-256 though, right? Like it's, I mean, it's the same problem, but it's like one very simple computation versus.
Yeah.
It has no other productive utility, right? Besides finding the
but you still have the fundamental problem of you don't know if they're doing it or not. So you need to come up with a mechanism for like, are you actually doing this? But I agree.
Right.
I mean, the what's actually being done is much simpler.
Right.
But it's a similar pattern, I think.
Yeah.
Exactly. Anyway, so that I think that's an interesting,
I agree,
project, because I think it checks a lot of the boxes, like protocol level, and like it's you're unlikely to get steamrolled in 3 months. I mean, there might be a bunch of competing peer-to-peer networks, but the one that's like open source, open money, like a truly structured as a public good, like with the licensing and who the contributors are.
Yeah.
If you can really get momentum behind a project, it's going to be resilient against the startup du jour who comes out with something, or like even a shitcoin new project that where they make a lot of money off their token issuance or whatever.
Yeah.
I think it'll be resilient to that. So I'd love to. I mean, so that, I think that's interesting. And then like, what are the other dozen projects like that have a similar profile?
Yeah, and I think another interesting thing is, and by the way, I think a lot of this can piggyback on what Jesse is doing with Vora and Anthony with Maple, you know, because in theory, if you start giving people their own sort of edge AIs and their ability to bring their own hardware, and it's like kind of like the same way with mining, it's like we'll probably go through, you know, the early days of mining, there was the hobbyist peer. It's like just plug in your computer and make money. I think there's probably going to be some interesting way to kind of bootstrap a network like that, where it's like, hey, I bought a bunch of Mac Minis, you know, and I don't always have tasks for my OpenClaw to do. it'd be cool if there was some way of like, when I want to run my open claw, like I can, and when I can't, then I can sort of underwrite the cost of what I already paid for it. Like that, yeah, that
like,
to me seems
I like that a lot. That's kind of cool because it's very new and there's like this use case that's emergent that everybody kind of knows they need or thinks they need or wants. So I think that it kind of, at least it feels from a Spidey sense perspective, it feels like it's new enough. There's enough demand. Couldn't have been done before. Now it can. And like, it might be enough energy to bootstrap an ecosystem.
Actually, I want to make sure I understood what you said. You're saying like, an agent that supports cross models and farms out stuff in a smart way. Like what, like if your local model can handle it, it farms it out there because you get privacy, it's cheaper, et cetera. But if you need a more advanced, then you go out to a peer-to-peer network or you go to a frontier model.
Well, I think that's interesting too. And that could potentially play into this. But what I'm specifically saying is there's a lot of people that just bought Mac Minis and sometimes they're running their open claw to do stuff. But like, let's say 80 or 90% of the time, the Mac Mini is just sitting there doing nothing. If there was an easy way that you could just plug the Mac Mini in and contribute it to the GPU marketplace take your agent. And like, it's not just, it's like there's different levels of abstraction you could play this at. You could just do the hardware and just like plug in, make money. Or you could say, well, not only do I have this hardware, but I have hardware and I have a specific OpenClaw agent that I have been like, you know, using to build these products or like using to have this, like I've been having all these conversations with my Anthropic. Imagine if I had been having all of those with my own, you know, locally stored data around, you know, this Bitcoin bank idea. And then it's like, okay, if you want to talk to my guy, you know, you can talk to this agent and it has a premium over just the raw GPU cost because it also has all my context.
Okay. I feel like you could have some virtualization software on a Mac Mini that lets you kind of multi-home open claws that people could pay for to run. That's a cool idea. I like this.
I also like this idea.
If someone wants to explore that, hit me up because it's something I'm looking to back as well.
That's what I was going to say. It feels, I also like the idea, but it feels more commercial. Like it sounds like something you want, like we all might want to fund.
Yeah, we're all asking for
it. Which is awesome. Obviously, that's good.
It could be both.
So then I'd want to like through when we explore that more, like if we can tease out what could be the non-commercial open source stuff, components of it, and that could be interesting.
Well, for one thing, just the standard, how do these guys cooperate?
Yeah, I was gonna throw out a little bit, maybe it's a little bit of a different direction to explore, but I'm generally concerned about the viability of ideas that get very close to what the closed source models are doing, because the closed source models basically they raise tons of money, they give away so much value that you're kind of not playing on very even footing by saying, oh, I'm willing to accept, some people are saying, I'm willing to accept an inferior LLM experience because of this ideology. Okay, peace. I'm glad those people exist. You know, I want that
DK
future,
wishes
but
you peace. That's good.
I want that future, but also I want to know what can be done and what is the state of the art, what's the frontier possible. And that seems to be that, you know, you give away a bunch of tokens, you subsidize a bunch of tokens, you can see more what the future holds. So I'm generally like more cautious or skeptical around ideas that are more kind of right in line with competing with existing kind of commercial models, even though I'm a fan that, you know, people are going after that stuff. But I think there's other areas that are worth exploring. And I mean, we talked pretty extensively last week around the idea of like, how does like multi-agent orchestration work? To me, that feels like it's like peace, let everybody compete at the layer that it exists, but then try to coordinate their activities and become like a better interface for coordinating their activities. You get all the benefits of the subsidies that they're willing to grant to get their models more adoption, but you're ultimately more at an abstraction layer that is not super impacted by, you know, you're not locked in the way that you would be if you were tied to one CLI or one tool.
Can I double click on that, or do you want me to?
Yeah.
So, I agree. I mean, any use case where it's cross model, I think that's a good opportunity where you are unlikely to be steamrolled by the big AI companies because they're unlikely to support their competitors' models at tier one. But I'm still not sure it's a great open, like non-commercial open source project, because I worry that there'll be dozens or hundreds of VC-funded startups who will do the same thing and make it open source, make it work cross-model, but because they capture customers, that there is a business model there.
Right.
And so maybe establishing standards is a reason to do a non-commercial or sort of independent project, but that maybe like the sort of the headless standards, the protocol standards, and not the actual user-facing product.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I would love to see on that front, and I think eventually, I mean, look, I think a lot of these things maybe start as something open source, but then they could evolve into products, which is interesting. But in the same way that, you know, you guys have funded wallet scrutiny, I would love to fund model scrutiny for all this. Like, I don't know right now, one giant question I have, and one product could be, okay, I've got all these coordinating, like I've got the coordinator bot that goes and checks all these things for me. But like, one thing is, I don't even know, like, a source of truth. How do I know if one of these closed source models has started rugging me with ads? How do I know if someone discovers there's a poison pill in the Chinese models? Like, there's no source of truth I know of today. That to me seems like if there is like an objective, and ideally there should be many of these, but sort of objectively neutral, credible, like leaderboard or like wallet scrutiny for that, that seems like hugely
important. I like that framing. That's great.
I'm not suggesting you shouldn't try, but I would just point out that you could be part of a 1% test on ads. And so ChatGPT may be serving you ads, but may not be serving whoever generated the wallet scrutiny assessment. So I think I'm not trying to discourage it, but I'd try to figure out what can be achieved there, because I think the wallet scrutiny domain is, in a sense, a little bit simpler maybe to analyze and assess.
But if you wanted to get really creative with it, you could also be like, cool, like we do our own random sampling. So, and one way you could do it is with Bitcoin, right? So it's like, cool, you know, and maybe this turns into a product or a protocol, but it's like, we will pay you to like every whatever day, we have a set of 10 prompts or queries or actions we want to take, and we'll pay you to run this on these different versions of the models. And we gather all the data back and assess what's changed, what's not, like kind of redline the diff.
I just wanted to, Vinny had a comment here. He's saying that the difference between inference and Bitcoin is that inference requires much higher bandwidth and is not deterministic. Might not be possible to create a proof over that. But I mean, it's also not, the way Bitcoin mining works is it's not proving it either. I mean, it's proving that the miner is doing quite a bit of work. I mean, the miner like delivers back something that is not enough proof of work to mine a block, but enough proof of work to show like, okay, I'm putting in serious computational power. So that's not a proof.
Well, it's
a proof that directionally it is computing enough power. It's not proof that it's
interval or something, right?
Yeah, it's not proof that it's doing everything.
But I mean, that to me would be an incredible open source project or research project. Is like, how far can we get that? I think that's an open question. I also want to also answer Vinny's other point. Bitcoin isn't the bank, because I was talking about trying to build a bank for all these agents. To be clear, the way I'm thinking about it is, I think there will be banks that are Bitcoin-based banks that are, you know, potentially lending to the agents. So that's where I'm thinking.
Ram says, did y'all talk about Meta acquiring Moltbook? Ads are coming to agents, and your agents will influence you to buy certain products.
We didn't even talk about that. That's big.
Well, we sort of addressed ads in LLMs, right?
We talked about the ads part.
No, we didn't talk about Moltbook getting acquired by Facebook, though. Yeah. That's kind of interesting.
That's I'm looking forward to when Matt Belez gets acquired. Or actually, I'm not looking forward to it. Yeah, it's viral. But meaning conceptual, like Origram. Right. Like, right, I don't know. The whole Moltbook thing seems kind of like crazy acquisition.
But. Yeah. I mean, did y'all have any takes on that? And by the way, DK, I've heard multiple people from last week say they really liked your idea about Slack for agents. So, I mean, this is at least one data point. Other companies like that direction too. I don't know. Do y'all have any hot takes or thoughts on this?
Well, I don't know that I read too much into it. I think Moltbook is fun and cool, but I think, as I framed it before, I think it's performance art. It's like, hey, here's kind of a future sci-fi of what it could be. It's not like these agents are really acting unprompted. So I think it's fun and cool that we have such a thing. You know, it got acquired. Acquired could mean everything from they got jobs to they each got $1 billion paydays. I don't know which it was. You know, it's hard for me to speculate. Probably, you know, closer to the former. But not necessarily what you might think of as a regular job. So, you know, we could get a very nice kind of signing bonus. So I wouldn't read too much into it. And I think, you know, I think Meta is in a tough spot. So I think, you know, trying to, like, they did the what was the guy's name? The Alexander Wang what was the company? You know, the
Scale.
Yeah. Right. So they did Scale, and then, you know, that seems to be kind of crumbling, and they acquired a bunch of, you know, visionary people, and that doesn't seem to be going anywhere. I don't know what assets they have to bring to this fight. So I'm kind of like, okay, try another one. Why not? I mean, it's existential. You have to try to compete here, but I don't know that I've seen a move yet that I'm like, okay, that makes sense to me. And multiple certainly hasn't really changed the, I don't know. Yeah. Anything I've seen.
You want to say Matt Coates comment?
Yeah, I mean, he just says, don't know why they bought Moldbook when Facebook was already bots talking to bots. Well played, sir.
True.
Yeah.
So back to, so you've already come up with a couple of good ideas. I want to keep the ideas flowing here.
I've got one out of left field. I mentioned this briefly in the chat, and I don't think I got much uptake, but I'll mention most of my computing I do with an open source tool called Open Super Whisper, and it's a hotkey that I tap, and that is how I input. I basically try to not touch my keyboard, and I only speak to my computer. Now, that's an open source project. It's very general purpose, but I think that's actually kind of like a very nice style of entry point to multi-agent orchestration, or what does the future operating system look like? Like whether it's on a mobile device or on a laptop, I think we're going to be speaking to our computers. Like almost whenever we can, we'll choose to do that once we've tried. And so, you know, maybe something in like the
Super Whisper is closed source. Open Whisper is the open source version.
So I use an open source thing called Open Super Whisper, but there may be other open source.
Whisper Flow is what I'm using, and that's what DK started with. And even though he likes this other thing better, he told me to start with Whisper Flow. So I'm starting with that. And it's amazing technology. Yeah. I mean, beyond the behavioral shift you're talking about, it is incredible. Its accuracy, and its accuracy with, well, whispering, right? You can have a lot of ambient noise around you and whisper it at a crazy low volume level, and it gets it perfect. It's amazing.
Is anyone yet building, and perhaps we had someone in the chat that's touching this, open ASMR? What do you mean, DK?
So actually, DK, I have a question though. I mean, so I'm still early days changing my own behavior. So I'm not, I don't have personal evidence yet, but I totally buy into your conviction on how it is so much more powerful and easier and et cetera. But I know from my Google Glass days in which you could speak to that too. And in certain situations, it was, even though the technology was not as good then as it is now, it was way more natural, faster, blah, 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 everything you're saying. But there's many environments in which you either can't speak or it's awkward. Now with this whisper technology, you can literally whisper. So that opens up more environments in which you could use it. In fact, I'm going to test it here at Presidio Bitcoin and see if I annoy my neighbors by doing it. But I want to dive into the annoyance. So here's my question to you. It's definitely socially weird if you see someone whispering to themselves. Like you think they have mental problems, right?
Yeah.
So let's assume there's like such tremendous value to speaking, and the technology allows for whispering such that people start whispering to their, you know, device here in their ear or whatever. Yep. Do you think it'll become socially acceptable? Like, will it no longer be like, this person has mental issues?
Every time there's a big technology change, the early adopters look awkward and weird, and then finally that becomes like habit. Remember like in the 90s, it was so weird to date somebody online. And now it's just like everybody does that. That was like very socially awkward. And then 30 years later, it's just like the standard, right? I think that kind of thing happens all the time.
But to be clear, it could go another way too, which is like, I don't know, like I don't want to be in an office like with everyone whispering with each other. That feels uncomfortable for me.
Well, maybe you shouldn't be in an office. Maybe you should be taking a walk.
This is my point.
Computing should mostly be done out in nature.
that's what I was going to say. Like the hopeful version to me is not that like you have people in cubicles sitting there like, bizarrely whispering in the corner. Like that seems like the meta, like strapped onto your face, like eating the bugs version, like, no thanks. I think, yeah, the good news would be you come together when you need to do stuff in person. And then, you know, if not exactly, maybe you're like out taking a walk or like at home or something. I don't know. Like I just,
but the count, or I mean, I totally agree on the awkwardness part and like going for a walk and be able to do stuff. I agree with all that. But this also, this suggests like the opposite of PB.
Right.
And we have proof now in the value of coming to, I mean, obviously historically there's plenty of proof of people going to an office, but then during COVID when everyone worked from home, maybe that was an event where everyone's like, oh, it's way better to work from home. Everyone should work from home. But PB is proving out that people are volunteering, like, because we're not a company where we demand our workers come to the office. Each person that comes here, it's their own choice, right? And we have people, literally 4 people now who've moved to San Francisco to come here.
We have more coming.
We have 8 to 10 people who commute 1 hour each way, 2, 3, 4 times a week. They are volunteering to do that because of the value of being here. So what is their future for inputting to devices if they're not going to be speaking or whispering?
I mean, at PB, there are, what, like 3 phone booths? Maybe the future is instead of these office desks right next to each other, maybe it's a farm of more phone booths, and you can kind of come out and still gather, and there's the lunchroom and coffee, and you can get lunch together. But maybe people, like when you're working, it's more deep work, focused work, and you're speaking to yourself in a phone booth environment. That seems fine to me. I don't feel like that's a...
Two thoughts on that. I mean, one is, I'll tell you my own work style. I mean, I love coming to PB and talking with people, but I don't do it every day. And part of the reason I don't do it every day is I like to kind of demarcate where, like, you know, if I really need to focus and like really go deep, often I would just stay home because like I know no one's going to talk to me. But like when I want to chat with people and like have like less, let's say, super deep work, then this is a way better environment. So maybe the sort of hybrid thing becomes more common. But I also think that, I don't know, like I don't totally buy that we're going to, like, I still think you want like some ability to visual, and maybe in the future we'll have the Google Glass or contacts and just like pull up a screen on demand. But like, you're not just going to be like sitting there like in the corner like this, like you will want to see a screen.
I think screens are great for consuming
right. What
the output is, right?
Yeah.
Not necessarily always required, but it's a great format. Like if you send me a photo, I don't want to hear an LLM read me. Here's this guy, you know, standing on a street corner, whatever. I want to see it, right? Like the visual is important. So I think we'll continue to have screens to see. I'm just pointing out, I think the importance of the keyboard is going to decrease dramatically.
Yeah.
And especially the other thing to think about, how is work going to change? You know, any given day, I'm usually working on I have 3 agents that are working. And I sort of have 3 different work streams in my head about what they're doing, but I'm not on with them all times. I dispatch something and then I go do something else.
And you check right? in.
And so check in. So maybe the future of work is not sit at a desk and interact with your agents and speak to them, but maybe it's like you dispatch, go to your phone booth, dispatch a few things, then go out and have a coffee and hang with your friends while the agents are doing the work, and then come back and check in when they're done.
So DK, as much as I really want to believe that, and I think that will be an option for a lot of people, I also have to show, even though I'm generally very much the optimist as well, and I think that a lot of people will find that path. That path seems like a good, happy path. I will also note the sort of dark path, because right, like the internet, you're like, oh man, it's gonna be so cool. We're all like doing cool stuff with like people right. on the internet. And then it's like, is Facebook just like, Instagram, and like single-handedly ruin society. But what I am also seeing, and by the way, I haven't gotten on Twitter in a couple of weeks, and I'm trying an experiment. I had Anjali change my password and I can't get on it. And it's been awesome. Like my life quality is improving. Which is an interesting little takeaway. I still use Stacker News.
I mean, I've, you know, at Christmas I decided to reduce, and I've 90% reduction of looking at social media. And
really?
I feel healthier.
And it feels better, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's no question on that. And by the way, but I don't feel like I miss out. You guys, if it's important enough, you'll send it to me. I'll see it on Stacker News. It's not like I'm missing out. I'm just not scrolling, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But I did it before I, you know, started my scroll detox, I guess. I noticed like people that were like, I think, I don't know, someone in the video is like, oh man, like there's this whole movement of like people are leaving their parties earlier because like their bots are working and they want to make sure they're maximizing every second. And instead of having 5 bots working, they want 10 bots working.
And it's like, yeah, I mean, it could be like people like go and like, you know, maybe in Europe, the European guys, you know, and I see we have a couple in there, they'll have their little cafe and a bot mm-hmm. working a day or two. But then, you know, here in America, I'll be like, I got 500 going. And I'm, you know. So I think it could easily swing the other way too, where I
think everybody is going to become the orchestrator of some team of bots.
Yes. Like, I think that's, I agree with that.
If you sit on the end of a computer, you know, like an internet connection with a computer, and that's your job, I think your job is going to be a bot orchestrator, not whatever you think it is today.
Yeah, I agree. And going back, DK, to what you suggested the future office might look like, I thought that was a good suggestion, or meaning like the phone booths we have now, more of those. So I'll commit to changing my own behavior at PB to experiment. So I'll, I'm going to, number one, speak more to the computer. I'll do it from my desk, which I'm expecting to be a failure, but I'll do it just to pick up on what works, what doesn't. I'll do it from a phone booth, in which I expect that to not be awkward or weird, but it will take me away from a little bit.
Right.
From the environment. So I want to see what is the sort of water cooler talk I miss out on by being in a phone booth. And then I'd like to experiment with somewhere in between the desk setup and the phone booth. Is there something else that you can like either, you know, maybe it's just visually. Because if you're truly whispering and others can't, if others can't hear it and it's just like visually weird to see someone's mouth moving, maybe you just need like to visually cover your face or something. I don't know.
Or we just need to get comfortable with it, right? Like,
or that
we'll get comfortable with a lot of things.
So I think experimenting with that'll be interesting, because then I think that it could literally change how the layout of PB. Or I mean, we'd have to encourage other, like we'd have to see PB members actually want to use voice all the time.
Yeah.
So we can encourage them to try. So I'll try, then get others to try. And if there's strong demand for it and people feel as strongly as you do, I could see changing like the layout of PB to accommodate that. And it's frankly like a experiment of future office space.
And I think one of the things that is going to be like pivotal in figuring out how you're experienced with it is basically how much of your day today is interacting with agents versus how much of your day is doing, you know, let's call it traditional way. So I suspect like I'm at the extreme of I just spend all my time with agents. And so I like see what that looks like and feels like, which is fine. I mean, I do other social things without agents, but I'm saying any like work related stuff is really just agent development.
Touch.
Sure. Right? Sure. DK.
Touch grass.
Yeah,
DK. Touch grass.
But what I'm saying is if your job, like Steve, I know you do a lot of like people and coordination stuff. So you're probably in emails and sending people emails and that kind of stuff. If you don't have like an open claw running in driving all of that activity for you, which I'm guessing you don't, I wouldn't recommend. Then you're probably going to have a very different relationship or experience with using agents to like do your work, right?
Yeah. Vinny asks, isn't this just a phone call? Well, not necessarily because of the whispering, because you can whisper and it works now. But on a phone call, that would be like super weird.
So the reason
we'll do an entire PBJ episode whispering, and everyone will be like, "Okay, that was weird."
The ASMR channel.
So we're sitting here in the corner, shaking back and forth.
what I was going to suggest though is I think this
right.
voice stuff.
We're good. We got it. It's awkward. It's weird.
The reason I raised the voice up, and I know we're kind of over time, so I don't want to get too far into this. But the reason I raised the voice stuff is because I think it's. You know, I'd say I have early visibility into how powerful it is in a version of work that I think is to become more common broadly in the future. And given that, to me, it starts to sound to my ear like there's, you know, a change in the relationship with how we interact with our computing devices is like a change in the operating system. And so I wonder if from an open source and funding perspective, there's a way to, you know, observe some of the like, you know, the fact that our computing devices and relationships may change. And if it is more voice-centric, are there new tools that would help our voice-centric controller build the bridge from our existing computing models to a voice-centric computing model, more than just hold a key, speak to a model, have it paste the text in, but can actually do stuff. So like a very simple thing I'd like to be able to do is I've got all these command line interface tools open on my desktop. I'd like to be able to speak to my phone while I'm off on a trail run and have it dispatch the thing correctly to the right command line interface, even though I'm not there to tap and click the stuff. So I'd like to just sit open on my Mac at home, and I can be out on the trail with I think there's an infinite design space there, so I'm not proposing that specific idea should be implemented. More like there's a big change happening here that I don't think is commonly appreciated yet enough because it's very niche.
I think we should touch on this again next week, because I have some thoughts around the difference between input and output text versus reading, or like listening and reading, because I think it's going to be a combo. But I do want to acknowledge one other thing, which is Austin says, quote, my PBJ bet for next week will be, do they actually cover the topics in the YouTube title? It's one, and we still should run a bet, a live a market next week. But I do want to say, since I don't want to totally wreck you guys, at least touch one of them. Strategy stretch spree. I just want to touch on this and just say, oh my fucking God, this is crazy. The last 2 days, if you guys don't understand what's happening, shout out to Ash, who's shared strc.live, I think that's right. Someone can correct me if that's wrong, but basically it shows you in real time how much money MicroStrategy is making selling Stretch, which is the sort of over collateralized Bitcoin credit, right now at an 11.5% interest rate, which is insane. I think the last 2 days, I forget the exact numbers, it was like 100 million. And then yesterday, well over 200 million. I saw there was like 200 and something million and 400 million quoted. I think the 400 million might have been total trading volume. 200 million plus was like new sales of that. But just like high level, you know, if you're selling $200 million worth of Stretch securities and then immediately putting all of that into Bitcoin, you're talking about buying at current prices. I think that'd be like, well, like 2,600 Bitcoin, something like that. So if you're wondering, hey, like, where's all this Bitcoin, you know, bid coming from? Coming from Stretch. And there's a lot more to
know. Was there something that structurally changed in recent, because Stretch as a vehicle, I think it's existed, I think it went public 6 months ago or more, maybe. So it's not that just came online, right? So was there some other factor that just recently drove a bunch of demand for that?
I think there's a couple of things. I don't know. This is my speculation. One thing is they keep hiking the rates, like six rate hikes back to back. So at some point, it's like when the rest of the...
And it started at 10% yield, now it's at 11.5%.
Started at 9.
Yeah, it was less. It was like, it was under 10. Okay. Maybe it was 9. And I think they've hiked it a quarter to a half point multiple times in a row. So now they're at 11.5%. And like at some point...
But to be clear, they're hiking because like there's not enough demand.
Well, there wasn't until this week, right?
Right.
So they found the sweet spot. It's like, turns out, you know, markets will discover the sweet spot. And the sweet spot was 11.5% apparently. And so, you know, that's one. Another thing is I saw a headline maybe last week about one of these, I don't know, some sort of financial firm. It was not exactly a rating agency, but basically giving it a buy rating. It seems like Sailor's been doing road shows. I've heard from multiple people talking with a lot of people. It seems like basically behind closed doors, you know, the sell is just a lot easier to say, hey, you know, Mr. Fixed Income Credit Guy. Right. You're making 4% with a lot of risk on this, you know, municipal bond. We'll pay you an 11.5%, 6x over collateralized, and it's extremely liquid. You can sell it at a moment's notice and get full.
Well, there's in between there, back. Even isn't there like a 7-9% is common in, I think, junk bond markets. So
maybe, yeah.
I think the alternative is you take a very high risk. Like, I don't think people are saying treasuries are risky. They may. I mean, I could think that, and you may think that, but I don't know that the professionals typically think that. But I think they're comparing it to something like a junk bond or high yield bond.
Yeah.
And this still blows that out of the water, and it looks much less risky because you don't really need to worry about the business operations, right?
And actually, you saying that makes it more credible to say that you just said 11.5% might be the sweet spot, right?
Right.
Well, so I was initially thinking, well, 9, 11, what's the difference compared to like 4 or whatever? But if you're comparing it to junk bonds, and the junk bonds are 7-9, well, then 9% for this whole new thing and this whole new risk that is new to you to assess, it's like, I'll just go with junk bonds. I know that world.
Yeah.
But if you get 250 extra basis points, then that, you know, then it might tip the scales.
I also want to give a shout out to Borja and his company, Roxum. We've talked about them before. You know, I've mentioned many times, I've become increasingly bullish on them over the years. And I think it was yesterday or the day before, they announced their new product offering, which I think is genius, absolute genius. And it's the ability to, they're now through their, not available to U.S. citizens right now, unfortunately, but if you're outside of the United States, you can buy Stretch on their exchange with Bitcoin and get the yield paid in Bitcoin. And that's pretty interesting.
I think we have at least one Canadian listening right now. So maybe that person can can
test just that. Make sure I told my friend the next one. You deposit Bitcoin into Roxham and they custody Bitcoin for you, and then they pay you 11% or 11.5%.
I don't know if they're taking any of the spread or not, but yeah, maybe not.
In
sure
Bitcoin.
In Bitcoin.
You are giving up custody, but you are getting a stretch yield on that.
That's my understanding.
Wow, so, that's kind of crazy.
It's kind of genius.
That seems, more common?
It's literally the smartest product I've ever heard. And there's some big, big things I can imagine them doing next. So
I mean, I'm not saying, you know, it's still.
Notchcoin, all the usual caveats, but just from what will actually work in the world, genius.
But from market's perspective, I think that seems savvy.
Yeah.
So we're way over, but just so we can check the box that we covered things in the title.
Yeah.
Quick news flash, which we usually don't do here, but there are two more product offerings announced in the past week, which support stablecoins on Bitcoin or related to this. One is Tether announced.
RGB thing.
UETXO? I might be butchering it, but something like that. It's very close to UTXO, but it's not UTXO. I think it's UETXO, I think.
Yeah.
In any case, it's their Bitcoin. They've actually been working on this for 4 years. It uses LDK, so I've known about this for a long time, but it's an RGB-based, LDK-based system. So it's using Lightning. It's better than the original Tether on Bitcoin because that was on-chain, didn't scale very well. Now it's using Lightning, scales better. And the second news is Arc Labs raised $5 million in change.
Yeah.
With Tether, I think, was the lead, but there are some other notable investors in it. But along with that investment was bringing stablecoins and Tether to Arc Labs as well, and Arc technology.
Yeah.
So the more the merrier. It just adds to the...
Every day, Bitcoin gets stronger.
What would need to happen then for one or each of those to take off? Do you need a major issuer like a Circle or a Tether to choose into that system?
Well, you need a number of things, but I mean, the first box they check is that Tether... The one is from Tether, so obviously Tether will exist on that, and then Tether the token, and then because Tether invested in Arc Labs, I mean they're bringing Tether to that. So both of those solutions will have
Tether
tokens. Now you need more than that. You need network effects, adoption, usage, etc. And that's tough. That's a tough nut to crack.
Yeah.
Can Tether do things to encourage that? Because presumably Tether would like these other solutions that are a little more open than maybe Sol, Tron, ETH, stuff that they may historically have been on. So are they...
Well, if I'm Tether, I think what I definitely don't want to see is more of these, or corp chains winning.
Right.
So a Tempo, Base, etc. Then so that would be enemy number one. And then the next tier would be Solana, Ethereum, layer one that are relatively more decentralized than the aforementioned ones. But I think, I think the folks buying Tether are pretty hardcore Bitcoiners and they get Bitcoin and they would rather see Bitcoin as a platform. So
they could share more yield. I mean that would be able to invest.
Is that possible? Can they take some of the yield and share it back to drive maybe wallet adoption?
You can't do that in the US, but you could do that. Or I don't know. I mean, I don't know the rules of other jurisdictions, but you could maybe do that outside
the US. But
phenomena is excellent.
I mean, that's why Stretch tokens exist outside the US. So it apparently is more regulatory friendly.
Well, and this is what I was going to say is to come back to the whole Stretch thing, not to just simp on MicroStrategy, but I don't know what's going to happen in the United States because of regulatory, but in my mind, nothing can compete with Wrap Stretch for the stablecoin. Nothing. I mean, you just think about, we have this one, the Buck token, maybe that one is in particular scammy, I don't know, but if they're giving an 11.5%, hell, they're giving 7%, and you can wrap that and keep 2% and give away the 5% to 9.5% to your users. That's just going to dominate. I think Stretch, Stretch has already won. It's who's going to figure out how to productize that for the stablecoin offering? Maybe it'll be Tether, maybe it'll be someone else. But I don't even see Tether with their measly treasury yield able to compete in that world. I actually think Tether is vulnerable right now.
I'm optimistic on, you know, what MicroStrategy is doing, but I'll just ask the question, you know, the yield, the 11.5% yield is coming from the presumed growth of the Bitcoin assets that underlie that. And I think he generally models it at 20 or 30% compounded annual, you know, in the next 10 years or so.
Yeah.
And so, so 11.5 is maybe sharing about half of that, maybe protecting some buffer for volatility.
But, right,
you know, what's to keep an upstart from coming in and saying, we're offering 15% on a small stack, so we can't absorb as much liquidity, but we're going to get 15% yield. And we're just going to hope that, you know, that the enough buffer in the 20, 30%, the drawdown and sequence of returns doesn't cause a problem.
If you have to ask, you're the yield.
Well, anybody who accepts the yield is that person.
Yeah. I mean, to be clear, I'm not looking for the yield. But I mean, I think the short answer is, like, we've talked about this before, but like, there are moats around who can raise capital in the event of a downturn. He has proven, at least through two bear markets so far, that he's not taking sufficient leverage to sell down the stack. I would be very skeptical of an upstart. It would be not only difficult to build that trust, but for them to actually manage the liquidity to be able to raise the capital. It's not saying it's impossible. And like, there is like clearly like a buffer, like between whatever the actual yield they're offering and the CAGR is, like that's the value. I just think they have so much, such deep capital relationships, brand record. I think it's gonna be super hard. So much volatility around the actual instruments they're trading. There's like markets on markets on top of MicroStrategy stock, on top of Stretch now. So, I mean, it's possible, but like that's not a game I would want to play to go after Sailor.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. All right. Is that a optimistic enough ending?
I think that's a wrap.
Austin's happy because we covered the topic. So there we go. Have a good weekend, everyone.
As DK would say, peace.
Peace.